Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I truly, I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds podcast with Danny V. Today I talk to Stephanie Bishop. Stephanie's first novel was The Singing, for which she was named one of Sydney Morning Herald's best young Australian novelists. Her second novel, The Other Side of the World, was named Literary Fiction Book of the Year at the Australian Book Industry Awards 2016 and was the winner of the Readings Prize for the New Australian Fiction 2015. Today we chat about her third novel, Man Out of Time. We discuss mental illness, the father-daughter relationship, and turning memories into fiction. Due to the nature of the book and the character's struggles with mental illness, the conversation may act as a trigger for some people. If you're experiencing difficulties, head to www.beyondblue.org.au. I'm your host, Danny V.
Welcome, Stephanie. Thank you so much for chatting with me about Man Out of Time today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to be on the podcast.
I really loved this novel. I just thought it was so full of complexity, but so beautifully written. Now, the novel has been described as an unsettling bond between a father and a child. How did this story emerge for you?
It evolved fairly slowly over really looking back. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but really over about a decade. It wasn't entirely deliberate. I don't think I really knew what I was doing until quite close to the end of that 10-year working process. It started off in some sense of wanting to explore the relationship between a father and a daughter, that drew on aspects of my own history, in the sense that my father had very severe depression. My memory of that is not entirely clear. It's not reliable. My memories are contested by family members. We all have different versions of those years. But I was interested in thinking back through the emotional memories that I associated with that time and using those as a springboard for fiction. So that was always one of the sources of the book. But that changed over the years as the characters evolved and kind of drifted into new forms. But that was always the starting point, and the thing that I kept returning back to and trying to find a way to represent that experience in a way that I found that was meaningful and that didn't reduce it to something, I suppose, that didn't try to pathologize it or to cure it, but to represent it in its genuine complexity in terms of what it is to experience that illness. Or
just continuing on that point, I often see or read books about the complexity of the mother-daughter relationship. So it was very interesting to read about a father and daughter relationship, because I don't think that has been deemed to be as complex. And I love one of the parts of the book where he says, a father always loves a daughter too much and it overlaps too easily with the love he should feel for the child's mother.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think you have to really go back to Greek drama, really, where that relationship between a father and a daughter is explored consistently, in relation to a kind of tragic narrative, I suppose. I don't know why there is that kind of gap. I assume that it's partly to do with the idea of lineage, you know, that mother-daughter narratives hinge upon the idea of continuity and crossover of identity because of, you know, proximity of gender, and assume that the bond there is intense because of that. And I think similarly with father-son narratives, that it's the idea that the father will somehow pass something on to the son and that the son will model himself in the light of his father. The gender difference seems to kind of mean that those narratives, the crossover between a father and a daughter or a mother and a son, don't get picked up in the same way or don't get treated in the same way often.
The book also details Leon's experiences, and you were talking about how you were drawing from your own experiences of memory. And as we know, and as you mentioned, memory is can be taken from different perspectives and is often questioned because, you know, you have a very different memory to the other people and their experiences. How do you separate fiction from your memories and make it a fictional book, even though you've drawn upon your own experiences?
It differs at different points. I mean, in some ways, I think, really, all our memories are pretty fictional, and we know. I mean, science talks a lot about this, neuroscience at the moment, in terms of the way in which memory is constantly being revised. Every time you have an experience, you're adapting, or each time you remember something in a particular moment, you're readapting and changing that memory in light of the contemporary experience that you're having. So on a very practical level, our memory is something that is fictional and is something that is always under construction. So I kind of use that idea as a way of, I suppose, of not feeling that one needs to be too precious about worrying about where one stops and where the other one starts. So there is that sense in which when I go to writing, the process of writing is one in which I actually deliberately disregard the boundary between memory and fiction or between truth and fiction. But that's all. I do that as a starting point.
I like that idea. And it really blew my mind when I'd heard that before, about every time you remember a memory, it then changes depending on what you're doing and feeling at the time. Like, isn't that insane?
It's so interesting. And yeah, I find it bizarre. So there's always that as a kind of foundation. But then I think there's another thing in the sense, I always work from images, internal images. And so the process of that really involves some genuine experience, which might be entirely banal, which kind of, you know, associates or drifts off into some kind of daydream space and becomes fictional in a kind of process of evolution. So there is never a clear and hard line between the two. At some point, there is a tipping point. Where that tipping point lies, I don't know, you know, until I've crossed it.
I suppose memory as well is about the feeling you are left with, not the exact details of that moment, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, I don't know what the exact details of my moments were yesterday.
Yes.
But I remember the feeling.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would go back to that feeling if I were writing about it,
And that can't be wrong because, you know, whatever you're feeling, that can't be incorrect.
I mean, it's interesting. Somebody could still tell me that feeling was not justified, but that doesn't mean I didn't have it.
Exactly. Now, you talked about how you started from images, and what I found interesting was the inclusion of photographs in the novel. Tell us about how this is a really unique aspect of the novel.
Yeah, I mean, they were something that happened quite by happenstance. I had got really significantly stuck with the book. I'd abandoned it a couple of times before and then had got to a point again where I couldn't imagine anything, I couldn't see anything happening. The characters seemed to have stalled. And at one point I gave the character of Stella, a discovery. She discovered a collection of her father's photographs. And after writing that scene, I thought it was just such a deliberate cliche, such an obvious cliche that I couldn't go any further with it. And so I put the book aside, only to receive a phone call from a family member a few weeks later saying that they had a box of family papers for me and they thought I should have these. And so I collected them. And at the bottom of this was a bag of photographic negatives. And it felt such a strange coincidence, you know, an enormous coincidence of some kind of huge magnitude, that I ended up developing the photographs and trying to use them as a way of restarting the novel, of restarting the narrative, because the narrative had stalled so badly. And so I used them throughout the drafting of the kind of final, what became the final book. I use them to build a narrative throughout the story. So although there's only several photographs that appear in the novel, they underpin the development of the plot, I suppose you'd say, at every point. So there was a period in which it felt very much like an experiment in art writing, whereby I'd set myself a sort of series of tasks and limits around how I could use the photographs, and had to kind of write about every single one of them and figure out how to include that content in the novel. And then at the very end, it wasn't until quite late in the process that I decided to put some of those photographs in the book. I didn't want them to be illustrative. I wanted the image to be part of the writing. And then at the end, decided to kind of include some of the actual pictures.
Yeah, it was so interesting to me because I haven't seen that very much before in novels. And then later on, you've got those little pictures of the tunnels and the dots.
Tell
us about that. I found that really intriguing as well.
Yeah, they're not related to the photographs. They were part of an artwork that a friend gave to me, and I used those for a completely separate purpose to give to Leon at that point when he's hospitalised, and kind of really seeing his life in a kind of hallucinogenic, you know, he's undergoing a period of psychosis when those images appear, and they do kind of function as mental images for him at that point. So I've taken them really, again, entirely out of context and used them to kind of exaggerate his internal space, I suppose.
And from a reader's perspective, I found that it enabled us to have a better understanding of what he was going through, because, you know, we're in his head and we're finding out his experiences, but to have those images of that real psychosis and experience, it made it deeper for us, I think, as readers.
That's lovely. I'm really glad to hear that. I mean, it's interesting. No one's really asked a lot about those images, so I was never quite sure whether, you know, what the experience of that was for people. That's really quite nice to hear. I mean, there was a period earlier on in the writing of the book, before it became the kind of book that it is now, where at one point it was all from Stella's perspective, or an earlier version of Stella. And that didn't seem to work. It didn't seem to get close enough to the experience or to her relationship with her father. But I wasn't sure, I suppose ethically, but also just psychologically and emotionally, how I would give voice to a character like Leon in his extremis. So the images were a way of helping to kind of find a way into that, to find a different route into his consciousness, I suppose.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine a different book now with just Stella's voice, because I thought both of them, you know, both those voices were so important to tell that story of their intertwining of their relationship.
Yeah. And I mean, in the version before Stella, it was just Leon. That didn't work either. So it's really getting to that point where, for me, it was realizing that to represent that particular triangulation of that relationship and the experience of his illness, it only kind of came alive once you understood it in a sociable context and you saw how it was impacting on people and the unreliability of that experience. So it always had to be, it had to become a much more complex family unit than it was in the earlier drafts.
And speaking about the impact mental illness has on other people, I found that really interesting because we obviously, you know, we go through Leon's experiences with him, but then we also see the impact on Francis and Stella, and about, you know, trauma being something that is inherited. And I thought this was a really interesting aspect to explore.
In the earlier drafts of the novel, the ones that really didn't work, it took me a while to understand that one of the common failings of those drafts was that I was looking for a narrative that was principally a narrative that was based on the idea of the illness being cured and having a cause, or having a cause and therefore being possible to find a cure because you knew what the cause was, or you could treat the cause, etc. I mean, all illness has a narrative, and we buy into certain narratives over others in the pursuit of curing an illness. But the problem with Leon's illness, which for all purposes looks something like bipolar or severe depression with psychosis, the problem I realized for his experience was that he didn't know what the cause was. No one could tell him. He didn't seem to be clear on what the possible causes were or to believe in that causal narrative. So once I did away with that idea, the novel started to work better in some way. Once I realized that it couldn't be premised on the idea of causality of one thing making another thing happen, and therefore we get to a resolution eventually. So Stella's predicament is partly that she ends up in a situation when she's slightly older whereby she picks up this narrative which is almost endless because it is not curable, because it doesn't have a cause. So the transmission of trauma is partly Leon's in the first instance, in that his brother has suicided. We don't know why. He doesn't seem to ask why or know why. That's not clear. And his own illness starts to build from there. And again, there is no kind of clear understanding of why. And this is part of the trauma, is that nobody knows why this is happening. Therefore, nobody can cure it. And Stella, in turn, carries this story into her life and has to somehow make sense of this for herself in terms of, well, what do you do with that kind of suffering when it is inexplicable? So the narrative kind of started to build around that idea.
But there's authenticity in that, isn't there, when you're talking about mental illness particularly? I mean, I have anxiety, not to the extent, you know, of Leon's, but sometimes someone will say, well, what was the trigger? And you'll be like, well, there was no trigger, you know? So that's quite authentic to say that sometimes there is no cause and no cure, and you kind of just have to live beside it.
Exactly. And that's Stella's, I suppose, that's her challenge throughout the later part of the book, is to kind of figure out, well, how do you simply come to terms with something that's not going away and that you can't understand, or that you can understand only intermittently.
Yes, because it's like a second self, I guess, or a second shadow just sitting beside you constantly or behind you.
Absolutely. And for Leon, that was his illness. And for Stella, it's almost the memory of Leon.
Mm-hmm.
So they both carry that kind of similar experience with them, although in relation to slightly different things. It was hard formally to figure out how to structure the book around that gap, because the novel as a form is so premised on that idea of causality, of, you know, a plot being A leads to B, leads to a climax, leads to a resolution. Mm-hmm. Once you do away with that kind of narrative structure, once I did that, it became both very difficult and much more exciting.
Mm-hmm. And in 2018, we're quite comfortable talking about mental illness and, you know, talking about my own anxiety. But back in the context of when this was happening for your character, it was 1982 to 1992, and there was still quite a misunderstanding or a stigma, mm-hmm. perhaps, and very little language to articulate mental illness.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. I mean, it's interesting, looking back, for example, over my father's life, when I was a child, there was no, as a younger child, there was no language to understand that experience, just none. An enormous stigma, even through the 90s, you know, and a constantly shifting diagnostic terrain, which is with us now still, but which has real implications for how you try and understand your experience if your disease is affecting your very sense of self. So the situation that Stella is in is one of an extreme lack of language to try and understand the predicament that the entire family finds themselves in.
Because I feel like once you have some language to articulate it, you can begin to understand some of it at least, or explain it. And without that, you're kind of lost. And I feel that Leon is so lost.
Yeah, I mean, he is. And he is partly because the diagnoses are not helpful and not clear, and the treatment is neither of those either. The medical information that Frances, his wife, receives doesn't help either, that she's effectively told to kind of abandon him in some way because he won't be returning to his former sense of self, and she refuses to do this. But there's no language to help them understand the process. They are left to their own devices, really, to figure out how to navigate that experience without any language describe it. Yeah.
And in some ways, it's a coming of age story for Stella. And I really liked how she was always trying to make sense of the world, and if not of her father's illness, but wanting to understand, for example, how the frog worked. And, you know, she did some pretty gross things for keeping it in the freezer. But I thought that childhood curiosity, and when you're also living with a father with such a serious mental illness, you're probably very curious about how things work. And if you can understand how this frog works, or maybe you can understand how her father works or how the brain works, you know, it was a bit, you know, there was some humour in the grossness of it, but I thought it was really important as well in terms of her trying to make sense of the world.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose she does that at certain periods throughout her life in the book, that she tries to, you know, inquire very deeply into the way in which things work, whether that's the physical body of something or questions about the structure of the universe or the cosmos or whatever it is. As a character, she's incredibly inquisitive, but also tries to approach things with some sort of logical bent to unpack them. And I suppose that's one of the things that she and Leon, that's one of the means by which they bond. They both go seeking answers in the world in a certain kind of way, and share a naivety in that sense.
And something I loved so much about how you describe Stella, especially as a young girl, when she's asking for these presents from the fairies, a donut, a princess dress, golden shoes, a cupcake, all pretty straightforward, and then a lizard in a jar. And I thought, how beautifully does that sum up little girls, right?
I mean, there is that kind of fantastic illogicality of childhood that Stella is still part of, you know, at that age, 9 or so, when Leon returns after his first period of hospitalization. And that unevenness in her character of going from something quite girly to something quite practical to kind of logical things to stuff that seems just entirely irrational, that unevenness and unpredictability is both kind of a core part of that childhood space. But again, also something that allows her and Leon to build a new or even if it's a rather troubling relationship as she grows older, because he shares that childlike view and that unevenness of approach to the world, whereby you swerve from something predictable to something entirely weird and irrational.
Oh, I loved that about her. And yeah, right, I think it did bond them, but I just loved because it just summed up little girls so beautifully. You know, you can just see her in the golden shoes and a princess dress with a lizard in a jar and being so happy. Like, this is living my best life, right? It's interesting that you said that you grew up with a father with a similar experience of mental illness, because I felt that Leon was captured so authentically, and I wrote that question before I actually found out your experience. And just some of the things that he would say, you know, I mean, I don't ever pretend to think that I've suffered as much as Leon has, but, you know, some of the things that he says it would be quiet. No one would ask him anything. He would not need to talk or eat or drink or shower or comb his hair. And later he says, everything is flat. I don't feel anything, grey concrete. And I feel like those feelings and those simple chores have become such a burden to him, and he's exhausted.
Yeah. Yeah, he's exhausted in every possible way. And the relief that he seeks is simply to be relieved of that exhaustion, relieved of the burden of having to kind of care for himself in a routine fashion. That when he goes or when he moves closer to those points of, well, suicidal ideation, when he starts to consider suicide and talk about that, it's not ever so much in the terms of wanting to die. It's that these ordinary tasks, he doesn't have the energy for them anymore. He's just too tired.
It's so sad, isn't it? That those things just made me so sad, because once, you know, the pleasure of eating or drinking or, you know, just taking care of yourself is becomes a burden. I mean, I just found that so sad.
Yeah, and I suppose too, you know, I mean, I didn't really want it to kind of move into the space of the drama of that experience, but just the running out of energy for the ordinary things that, you know, in the best sense, we take great pleasure in.
I think it for me, it kind of, I mean, I'm not going to pretend, you know, that I have any experience with depression, but it kind of tried to make sense of the feelings, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose it's interesting because in the absence of any medical language, that's all he could do.
Mm. Yep.
There was no other terms of reference by which he could say, this is what is happening to me. All he could do was try and unpack the things he was feeling in the language that he had to describe those feelings.
And also, I think as he aged, you know, the loss of dreams and hope that youth often gives us, because he says, you know, he was tired of having reached an age where he could only be this person. And I thought, when you're young, you don't think that, because you can still be anyone, you know. Yeah. But I guess once you reach a certain point, and, you know, I hope this isn't true anymore, because isn't, you know, like 40 the new 30 and 50 the new 40, all that kind of stuff. But in his context, you know, back in the 80s, 90s, it was like, this is it for me. And I find that really sad that youth gives you hope. Whereas, you know, I spoke to someone else about this, but surely aging provides you with many other things, you know, like richness of life and experience and wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, by the time he's got to that point, it's interesting. We don't really know much about what his hopes were, other than that he feels that he can't have any more, doesn't have any more. I don't know if it would matter if he had actually achieved the things that he wanted. I don't know if that would have made a difference to him or not in the context of the story. Yeah, but I suppose in a sense that's the thing that redeems Stella and that gives her an escape route, is that she moves her life forward at a certain point and in that way leaves those aspects of her past with her father behind her. And the novel tries to chart that transformation that occurs for her, you know, after his death. But she is much younger. Mm. I don't know what, if I'd set the novel in a different period where she was the older one looking back, I don't know, maybe that would be different.
I really loved when you included the philosopher Albert Camus, who said, without beauty, love or danger, it would be almost easy to live. And you think, yeah, that's right. But also, what then would you live for, you know? How did that quote resonate for you?
Well, it's funny. I mean, it's something of a riddle, which is kind of why I like it. I mean, it sort of suggests that those are the things that beauty, love and danger are the things that make life worth living and also make life impossible to live. And I liked that. And it seemed to fit for Leon's struggle very much and for Stella's in the later part of the book, whereby the very things that give you meaning are also the things that cause you the greatest pain.
Yeah.
And that became Stella's motto, really.
Absolutely. Now, I found the prose quite poetic and fluid. It actually reminded me of Andrew Hutchinson's novel, One, because I just loved that poetic feel of it. And I thought that was... I'm wondering if that was a real deliberate choice because of the issues that you were dealing with in the novel.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I never kind of I didn't set out to do anything in particular stylistically other than to do what felt like, you know, the right thing. there wasn't a kind of poetic decision. I think that's probably just how I always write. If I'm not doing that in some way, I get incredibly bored and I have to find a sentence interesting in terms of language and rhythm and syntax. And if it's not interesting me, then I will tend to edit it out. But I do that with all whatever form I'm working in. So there were certain aspects of this whereby the syntax had to be really abbreviated, or there had to be, you know, a lack of certain grammatical properties in aspects of the text to suit Leon's mode of being. But generally speaking, it was just always, well, what can happen in this sentence that feels compelling to me and keeps me, you know, keyed into the language.
Mm-hmm. And so what's your writing process? Are you kind of a free writer where you go and just write and edit later, or are you always kind of editing as you go? Do you plan?
I tend to work pretty automatically at a certain point. So I will start writing fairly early in the day and the first few hours are fairly instinctive, but I won't tend to read over them. I will have a bit of an idea before I sit down of a set of things, either an experience I want to fictionalize or a memory I want to reinvestigate or an image that I want to kind of narrate and extend. So I will have some kind of guideline in the back of my mind that will simply be a starting point, a springboard. And then once that starts to move, then it will really be quite an associative process, I suppose. And I don't tend to look back on it. I normally set myself a point, like I will decide, okay, once I reach the end of this section or this chapter, I'll revise it at the end of the week. Or once I hit 40,000 words, then I will look back over the whole thing and see, you know, how it's going. But I certainly don't edit as I go, and I really would never edit every day. Maybe, you know, occasionally I will look back. And then I will do a very big, long editing kind of session over a period of weeks of thinking through things and fixing them and extending them. But I try when I'm in the midst of it to really turn that part of my brain off pretty totally, completely as possible.
Otherwise, you'd get nothing written. You just keep editing yourself.
Yeah, you would. And I kind of, my editing brain gets enough of a workout when I'm teaching that when I come to write, I try and not use it.
Fair enough. Now, this is your third novel. What was your publishing process like for this novel?
It was pretty smooth, really. I had a two-book contract with Hachette from when I signed for The Other Side of the World. I signed for this book as well. Although the description I gave for the book, not having written it, was quite different from the book that I ended up writing. But they seemed fine with that.
Oh, good.
Great. So I had about 3 years to, you know, come up with the book, and I had done, as I mentioned, these earlier drafts that were abysmal, and this I kind of considered this to be, okay, this is the chance to really try and make this work properly. So there was a contract lined up. Once I had about a year and a half into it, I had a full but extremely messy draft, and I gave that to my agent to read, and she had some enormously helpful feedback in terms of Stella, who was quite absent in sections of the novel. So it was a matter of bringing Stella and Leon up to an even level, I suppose, so that the book moved between them with a certain equilibrium. Once I'd given it to her, I gave it to my publisher, and then we kind of went back and forward for quite a while. My publisher had some extraordinary feedback and advice and really pushed me to make the book structurally far more complex than I had initially intended. So the first drafts were almost chronological, and she said, no, this beginning has to go, you know, this end has to go here, the beginning has to go here. And we really messed it up quite a bit in order to kind of get closer to the experience that was really at the heart of the story. If we'd done that, then it was pretty straightforward, and you know, I was a bit late on the deadline, but nothing terribly significant.
I'm sure that's not unusual.
No one's seen that worried except for me. Yeah.
They probably give you all writers a fake deadline to the real deadline.
I'm sure they do. Yeah. Well, originally they were hoping to put it out the year before.
Okay.
So we did change, you know, significantly change the release date, but everybody agreed that that was, you know, a better idea than publishing it before it was completely ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I interviewed Alice Nelson a couple of weeks ago, her beautiful book, The Children's House. I actually took her book and your book away with me when I went on a farm stay, which, funnily enough. And then Alice was like, oh, I'm friends with Stephanie, and I know that you wrote a blurb on her book.
Yeah.
Is it really important to have friends who also write so you can share those kind of challenges of the writing process with one another?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. There are certain points where you can talk to a friend who is, you know, working on a project of similar magnitude, who has been through that process. You can talk in shorthand, and that's such an extraordinary relief, and they can give you an answer in shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it feels at times like a kind of secret language that supports the work. And it's so many people say this, but it's such a long and very isolating process often, working on a book at certain stages of the writing process, that to have someone who you can talk through that experience or share that experience with, it makes it possible to finish it, really. Sometimes, though, you know, I mean, it doesn't always have to be a writer. Sometimes it's really good to talk to someone who has absolutely no idea, and you can tell them everything, and they think it sounds fascinating, and you can go on and on and on. But there is a certain kind of communion that you have with a friend who knows that process. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is your third novel. What's next for you? Have you got something in the pipeline? Have you got a number of ideas? Having a rest? What's going on?
I tend to work on a couple of things at the same time so I can move back and forward and not have to make too many decisions about either of them. When one stops, I can work on the other one. So I'm working on a collection of essays that's about all sorts of random things, really, but really the experience of art and the experience of making art in some form or another. And a novel which is at the moment, I don't know if it will stay this way, but at the moment it's a sequel to The Other Side of the World. It might become something completely different. But yeah, it's fun. I'm having fun with it. But my main brief for myself once I finished Man Out of Time was to just do things that felt, you know, quite joyful and easy, not easy in the sense that they weren't difficult, but easier emotionally. That was a hard book to write, and now I'm having fun doing other random things, microfictions and short essays and stuff like that.
So, yeah, I imagine emotionally and psychologically you would need a break from that, especially because you were drawing on parts of your own life as well.
Yeah, it was a you know, intellectually and emotionally a really quite exhausting by the time I got to the end of that. So it's nice to be doing other fun stuff.
That's good. Well, I really loved this novel. I felt it was beautiful and poetically written, and I just thought the content and the issues that it dealt with, it was so important. And like I said before, I just loved Stella. And I think more literature and more conversations about mental illness will continue to help us articulate it and find a language for it, and hopefully help people that suffer with these things to be able to feel like they're not alone, like Leon did. So I think it's a really important novel, not only to be entertained by, but really important for, you know, humans to be reading as well. So thank you so much for your time today, Stephanie.
Thanks so much for having me. It was lovely talking to you.